Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
Molly Carlisle has been talking about death for the last 20 years. She's a palliative care nurse who's also now the CEO of Southeast Palliative Care. And she's basically been focusing on these issues predominantly a lot of her working life. She's decided to share what she's learnt about death and dying in her book, The Death Talker. She's my guest in the drawing room, along with Caroline Mulcahy, CEO of Carers Victoria. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been calling yourself the Death Talker for some time now. How do people react when you describe yourself like that?
It keeps them more engaged, because if I tell them all the other things, you know, they get a bit bored.
Why this is so intriguing is that people do not like talking about death.
That's true.
How do you do it then?
For a starter, don't dress like a funeral director. You have a sense of humour. If you enter the conversation with compassion and connectedness with the other person, that overcomes people's fears, I think.
Why are you so passionate about the subject of death and dying?
I've always considered death to be a part of a human existence, and it's the one part that we all know we're going to experience, and yet people are very poorly prepared for. So when I was working in a clinical environment, the thing that dying people would tell me was that they didn't know how to tell the people that they loved the things they wanted to tell them. And then 2 minutes later, the carers would be saying, "We don't know how to say goodbye." And so for me, it's been a case of, if we have these conversations earlier, before anyone's ever sick, then we can talk about the stuff that matters to us, so that when the time comes, we can focus on our relationship instead of being scared of what's going to happen next, or not knowing about choices you can make, or continuing to have futile treatment just to make other people happy when it's making you really sick.
Caroline, you're from Carers Victoria, you're the CEO. How often do carers raise these issues that they also find it difficult to have those conversations?
Probably not often enough. I think our staff, as Molly said, lead those conversations with carers. I mean, these situations are something that you don't plan for. You often find yourself in unexpected caring situations. Carers are dealing with that day to day, and death is not something that people want to talk about naturally. It can happen very quickly. A caring situation can come upon you very quickly, but often carers care for a lifetime. So the end of life is not something that people just naturally want to talk about. They're not open about it, and it's a very difficult conversation to have with carers.
Molly, you mentioned before that people don't know how to say goodbye, and I think that's accurate for anyone who's, you know, either gone through the situation or seen others go through it. What do you advise them?
Well, people think they watch and see someone's breathing slowing down, and they're trying to time the moment where they need to say, "Bye now, Mum." But Mum's not going off on a holiday, and she's not going on a big journey. She's dying. So you don't actually have to say goodbye. What you need to be saying is things like, "I love you. I remember this that we did together. I will hold on to these things." If you put the conversation that way around, then people feel more confident to have it earlier. So they don't wait till the person's gasping and taking their last breaths, frightened of saying it too soon, because they can thread it in to the conversations that they're having while the person's deteriorating.
And if they do that, if they take that approach and thread it in, as you say, and it's not a goodbye, there's not a finality to the way they're saying it, but it's more reflective, how much does it help them later with the grieving process?
It makes a huge difference. One of my other hats is that I am a grief and bereavement counsellor, so I've done a lot of work with grieving people over a number of years. The people who really struggle to make sense of the death are the people who don't feel like they said what they needed to say. they're still stuck at the dying bit because they didn't get to do what they needed to do.
If you're just tuning in, you're in the drawing room and we're talking about pretty heavy topics tonight, death and dying. My guests are Molly Carlisle. She's the author of The Death Talker and also the CEO of Southeast Palliative Care. Also, Caroline Mulcahy, who is the CEO of Carers Victoria. Molly, what sort of things do you find most commonly that people don't consider when they go into this?
There's a whole range of things, but the first thing I would say is we have this evolved system over decades where people trust implicitly their healthcare team. And often members of the healthcare team are equally unable to have conversations about death. They see it as a personal failure as a health professional or as a system.
Because their job is to preserve life.
Exactly. Their job's to fix people. And when they can't, often people take that on board as a personal failing. So the temptation is to encourage people to continue with treatment, even though we know that that treatment's not actually going to do any good. And in fact, it may well impact on the person's quality of life for the time that they have left. But it happens because people feel like they've got to do something. So one more round of chemo or a bit more dialysis just so that we can offer them something. Whereas if we sat back and said, tell me about the stuff in your life that's really important to you, and got more of a handle on what that was, then we'd be able to step back and go, well, hang on, if it's really important for this person to go on a retreat for a weekend, they're not going to be able to do it if they've got their head in a bucket from their last lot of chemo that's going to do no good either. People can be informed and they can make choices based on their life and their relationships and what matters to them, not being put on a conveyor belt and following the same path as everybody else.
Caroline, people go into becoming carers for different reasons, sometimes completely unexpectedly, other times very much as a conscious decision. What are the things that they're not prepared for? Do you feel like everyone knows just how difficult it's likely to be?
Absolutely not. No, I don't think anyone expects to become a carer. And there are real different transition times and different journeys for different people. But as an ex-nurse myself, there's different caring situations. So you can be in a hospital, you can be in palliative care, you can be in the home. But when you become a carer, it is usually in a crisis situation. Something's happened to the person that you're caring for, or you've given birth to a child with disability, you have a sister or brother with a mental illness. There's been a crisis point, and it is a crisis for most carers. So they do forget about themselves and they concentrate on the person who requires care, and then they still forget down the track to actually care for themselves. But as Molly said, we don't know how to have those conversations. And when we're put into a caring role, we only focus on the person that we're caring for, not on ourselves.
So I wonder, do some cultures, and of course that's it's a pretty broad generalisation, but in your experience, both of you, I'll start with you, Molly, deal better with death?
I don't think there's better and worse. I think there's different. When I think about culture, I don't only think about ethnicity. I think about individual family cultures. So families have things that make them laugh that nobody else laughs at, or things that upset them that doesn't upset other people. So when you think about culture, I think culture is a very personal thing. If we treat each person as an individual and each family as an individual family, we'll be doing the right thing. But once you start lumping people together in groups, that's when people slip through the cracks.
Do you find that too, Caroline, that dealing with carers, and of course we live in a very multicultural country,
yeah,
carers come from very different places, that there are different ways that different carers behave?
Absolutely. But again, I agree with Molly. I don't think it necessarily is about culture. I mean, I've lived in West Africa. I've nursed in London. We've seen all of those ethno-specific groups and religions. But I agree with Molly. I think each family is an individual group. You know, even in healthcare settings, we often think that people's requests at the end of life are a bit weird. And I just wish that we would stop doing that. And I think that if you take those conversations...
What requests do people consider weird?
I remember being very confronted the first time a family asked me if they could take their deceased baby home to meet their siblings. And they brought the baby back the next day, having taken photographs of the baby with the brothers and sisters on their slide in the garden. We had a whole conversation as a medical unit, nurses and doctors, about that situation. It was a real light bulb moment for our ward, because we realised that we had preconceptions of what death and dying should be like and what we expected. And in hospital settings, you expect someone to die and they get taken to the morgue straight away, and we never see them again, and we don't have to deal with it. We don't have to deal with the emotions that we've just been through. The family leave and we get the next patient into the bed. That was a bit
so
weird.
That is a really different way to respond.
Yeah.
After being a bit confronted by it, because it is confronting, did you all kind of revisit your prejudices and think, well, hang on a minute.
Absolutely.
Perhaps this isn't weird. This is the process these people need to go through.
We actually then, having had a ward meeting, we then actually rang the police and asked the police to come in and talk to us, because we had to get permission from the police to take the baby home. And then we got the ambulance in and we rewrote our policies and procedures, and then we started asking parents if they'd like to do that. I mean, we were all young nurses at the time, young medical teams, but it just changed our whole perception and the way we manage death and dying for that next family.
Molly, you've been nodding a lot as she's been telling that story. It's a really, thank you for sharing that story. It's an incredible story, but it's true. Our initial reaction is that's morbid, this baby or this person has to go.
Our attitudes to this has changed a lot over the years, and I actually sit on a committee called the Natural Death Advocacy Network. Our whole modus operandi is to enable people who die at home to stay at home for as long as the family want them there, which may be 5 days if that's what they want, by providing them with a cool mattress so that their body remains cool and family can come, they can wash them, they can dress them. I mean, nowadays we can have things like a shrouded burial. My family know that's what I want. I've already got the material. My friend who's a designer is already teed up. My kids know that I want to be in a wicker coffin for the funeral with a big bowl of twisties on the top. That's the rule. And they know that afterwards, everyone has to come home and have a glass of brandy and listen to Rhapsody in Blue from the beginning to the end. We talk about this, and every Christmas, anyone who's changed their mind about something will say so. And, you know, my kids are in their 20s and they're having these conversations with their friends. The conversations move into groups then. You wouldn't let some random who you didn't know from a bar of soap plan and run your wedding, and yet we give away all the control around our death and our after-death care often to people we've never, ever met.
I think it actually runs deeper than that. I think when you're actually well, it's not something that even enters your mind, and it's not until maybe you become unwell that it does cross your mind, and then it's time to have that conversation. But I think I've had cancer myself, and during my treatment, all anybody wanted to talk to me was about my treatment and hope. People were desperate to give me hope and I was going to stay alive. And I think that human instinct where you fight to stay alive becomes very real. But it wasn't until after my treatment, and it could have probably been about a year after my treatment, that I started to think, actually, I could get this again. I had women dying around me who were in their early 20s, but I did start to think about how I was going to die. But it's interesting listening to Molly, because even though I've had that conversation with my own children who are 19 and 16, I've kept it quite superficial. So I've said to them, yep, I want to be cremated and you can take me back to England and put me in a wood on bluebells. But I haven't gone to the detail that Molly's gone to. And I think it's that detail that people probably need to start thinking about. And we've done a lot of work at Carers Victoria on advanced care directives and trying to get people to actually write down their preferences, and it can slip it in with will so that people know then, this is what I want at the end of my life, and I've thought about it, and please respect my wishes.
You have done both such a fantastic job of talking about a subject which I think lots of people find difficult, but you've made it sound effortless. Thank you to both of you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And that's Caroline Mulcahy. She is the CEO of Carers Victoria. Also Molly Carlisle, who's the author of The Death Talker, which you can get, what, from bookshops?
Online. It's out next week, so be quick.
Be quick. And she's also the CEO of Southeastern Palliative Care.